on today's News Talk TNT Radio.
All right, I'm Matt Arrett. This is Connecting the Dots, and we're back for the third hour. I am really happy to be joined by Alex Dimitrios, who is a journalist. He's done a lot of work as an editor of the Space Commune, and it's a wonderful website that I've really recently discovered. He works very closely with his colleague, Fox Green, who has been on our show a few weeks back. And Alex, I've been very impressed with your analysis, your mode of communication, and your insight into the importance of understanding energy geopolitics and the battle over energy. That's something that a lot of people miss out on. They don't appreciate, even people who are very astute on the complexities and sophistication of grand history and grand strategy and all these things. They often are very blind on the matter and importance of energy, and specifically nuclear energy. As something which has been fought over. How did you, and I mean, I'm referencing here an essay that I want to talk to you a little bit about today. Geopolitics proving that renewables are for show, energy is for dough. It's on spacecommune.com. How did you discover the importance of this energy policy and nuclear per se? Is that something you always understood, or is that something you kind of woke up to later on in the game like I did?
No, I only figured it out, my partner Fox Green and I, we live in the Hudson Valley in New York State. New York State is known as the Empire State, and we live near we live in the birthplace of democracy in the United States, in Kingston, New York, New York State's first capital. And the thing is, we lived near this amazing nuclear power plant called Indian Point, and it provided 25% of New York City's electricity nonstop for 40 years. It was one of the safest nuclear power plants in the world. And just through seeing our energy bills go up after environmentalists shut down the plant prematurely during the pandemic, noticing that and asking questions, okay, well, why, we were told that nuclear is so dangerous and so expensive. Why are our energy bills going up? We live in the state where, we're a leader on the climate. We've deindustrialized the state so much. There's no industry anymore sucking up power. Why are energy bills still going up? And that led us down this rabbit hole that revealed a lot of truths about not just how our energy bill works, how our energy grid works, but also about geopolitics and some of the games that the Malthusian oligarchs have been playing for decades now with other countries.
For people who say that nuclear power can be replaced by wind and solar, which has been a popular trope of the past few decades, I guess it probably took off in the 70s. I'm not too sure when it started. Can you just clarify quickly, why are they wrong? Why can these things never measure up to the quality of energy that nuclear brings to the table?
There's a lot of reasons. First of all, nuclear energy requires a very small amount of earth moved and materials to power a city for an entire year. So nuclear energy, I think it's something like 27 tons, something like that, of nuclear fuel can run a power plant for an entire year. So you can do that. You can do that shipment, very efficiently, maybe with a few trucks going back and forth. And then you can store the fuel on site, and it runs a city for an entire year. And that's why nuclear power is becoming a building block to national sovereignty, because you lock in your energy security with nuclear power. And that's why we're in the middle of this giant nuclear power and uranium boom, both geopolitically and in the markets. Another reason why nuclear power runs 24/7, so there's no dips. With wind and solar, it's very tied into the Gaia hypothesis, where they want to return us to praying to the gods for the ideal conditions. And that's why with a lot of devices that are, manufactured by ESG companies like Microsoft and Apple, you now see these things built in where they're like, oh, we're only going to charge your phone while the sun is shining or while the wind is blowing, because there's more renewable energy on the grid. And that's how we're going to help save the planet. So this is all tied into these, they're called intermittent sources of energy, where it's not 24/7. You can't just flip the switch like we're used to, have the power come on. The people that are trying to destroy our energy grid, especially in the West, They want to move us towards praying to the gods for the ideal conditions to have just enough power in the grid to charge your stuff, and then you're in darkness. You know, maybe you have a little battery, a little light that you can turn on at night, but then you don't have energy until the conditions are good again.
I never thought of it that way. By the way, I'm going to let you continue, but just to toss in a little 2 cents, I just appreciate that because I never really considered the Gaia hypothesis being so locked into, or the Gaia theory that some would wish that we adopt this new religion of worshiping the unknowable forces of nature and almost like doing rain dances again or sun dances mm-hmm. in some cases, so that the sun might shine in order for the gods to favor our solar panels. But that's sort of the orientation that it would go in, eh? At the end of the day, it is more locked in, or hope that the wind blows and do some sort of a ritual to satisfy the wind gods that maybe they'll blow again and make our turbines turn. It is uncomfortably close to that way of thinking.
Yeah. And if you look at how, especially in the West, how renewables have been adopted, they are agents of chaos. Renewable energy is an agent of chaos where it's intermittent, and what the government, the ideological people that are pushing it the most with government incentives and saying, oh, it's so cheap, let's build out a lot of solar and wind and just throw it onto the grid and see what happens. It adds such a level of complexity, and it forces more reliable sources of energy to scale up and down depending on what the weather conditions are. And that makes it harder for those reliable sources of energy to remain in business. So, for example, a natural gas plant, it now has to scale up and down depending on how intensely the sun is shining, depending on how many solar panels are working at that moment. They have to scale it up and down. That changes the margins of the natural gas plant so that it's harder for them to stay in business long enough to be on. You know, we have weather, we're here in the Northeast, and where you are in Canada, you know, we have some cold weather coming, and the utilities are buckling up and bracing for it, because the rest of the year with renewable energy, their business model has been challenged so deeply by these renewables. So then at this moment, they're like, okay, how much gas do we have on hand? You know, what money do we have left to buy energy where, you know, wherever we can get it? It's an agent of chaos, and it kind of ties into a larger theme, environmentalism, of monkey wrenching, of anarchism, where they want to destroy the reliable sources of energy that power our civilization, because at the end of the day, they hate civilization. So it goes pretty deep. And then, so nuclear energy ties back into it because it's known as a base load source of energy. It's the thing that they hate most, is that it's the most reliable thing that we can possibly have powering our energy grid.
No, yeah, that's straightforward and concise, and you just came out and said it, because at the end of the day, we can get forever locked into these discussions about the details of the green agenda and all of the different elements of windmills and solar panels and why they're ineffective. But at the end of the day, what it all comes down to is an intention, a simple but ugly intention that a lot of people are almost trained to not put into words or acknowledge, which is they hate humanity and want to reduce human beings down to something that's more controllable. And industrial civilization has kind of gotten in the way of that intention of restoring feudalism, because I guess industries and advanced energy sources give us an abundance. It makes it difficult to maintain the logical argument that there's only so much space to go around, guys. We have to adapt to scarcity. But what if there's no scarcity to adapt to? What if you create abundance? Yeah. Well, shoot.
Exactly.
Maybe you read a lot about the
Oh, I was just going to say, so that's why.
So I was going to say, you read a lot about the Malthusian agenda on this note. Sorry, there's a bit of a lag. Yeah. Could you maybe elaborate for those who may not know or haven't thought too much about, like, what is this Malthusian agenda? What is Malthus? Why is this an important concept for people to get into their mind? And anything else you want to say as well, touching on what I brought up, go for it.
Yeah, I mean, what people need to know, if they want to look into it more, Malthus was a guy in the I think early 1800s Right before there was this giant explosion in machining, in agriculture, in technology, and a seismic shift in how humans can manipulate the environment to support hu more human beings, more potential geniuses, more people to solve all of our problems and create new ones, but then solve those too. You know, that's the human, human paradox that keeps us going. He thought that, okay, we're going to run out of resources to support the population, and therefore we need to start doing things like crowding people into cities, getting people sick, to curb the population. And so the thing is, he was utterly proven wrong. Henry Carey did a lot to prove him wrong. Marx did some things that proved him wrong. History proved him wrong. But there are still people who are just saying that, oh, well, Malthus, he was wrong then, just because he wasn't proven right yet. And this next thing, this next decade, this is where it's going to happen. And this has been happening. There's always a new, hot overpopulation expert who's saying, oh, this is the time when the collapse is coming, and they're rooting for it. And with things like renewable energy, they're trying to bring about the collapse. So in examples like how the G7 are pushing a renewable-only agenda on Africa, is a clear example of Malthusianism in our modern age, where they're saying, oh, this is the empathetic choice. We don't want them to get addicted to fossil fuels like we did. We want them to have this clean energy. Africa, it seems sunny, so maybe, it's going to be a reliable source of energy. But what they're really doing is putting child brakes on, or the bumpers on the bowling alley lane to prevent them from fully developing and accelerating the rate of development that they can achieve with renewables. And that's the clear divide between G7 development, where they're spending hundreds of billions of dollars. One of the battlegrounds is South Africa, where there's two competing agendas. There's the BRICS agenda, the Belt and Road Initiative, paired with the agenda of Russia's Rosatom, which is their nationalized nuclear energy company, which is doing amazing things in Africa. Those, the BRICS alignment, they're pushing fossil fuels, they're pushing reliable sources of energy that can build civilization. And the G7 is pushing unreliable sources of energy. And Africa overwhelmingly is picking the reliable sources of energy. And that's where, in some of the articles that I shared before this interview, that's where our analysis is going, is that now the G7 is seeing this and they're saying, oh, you know what? Multipolarity is actually happening, and we're losing our grip on the world. We cannot prevent the world from developing the way we were. So now we have to. That's why all of a sudden all the objections of nuclear energy are evaporating, because the G7 countries are seeing, wait a second, Russia and China are actually successful at blowing up these narratives. Even though China has so much to gain from pushing renewables, they make, I think, 95% of the renewable supply chain is in China. They have abundant supplies of lithium that they're not afraid to mine. They have so much to gain from pushing renewables, but they're still not put in the developing world. They're not forcing countries to do that.
Yeah, I think that's going to set the stage for what we're going to talk about after the coming break, which is the issue of China and the multipolar alliance more generally, that is being animated by a very different paradigm than what we've been controlled by since especially the death of John F. Kennedy. And as you just pointed out in your article, you make the clear point that looking at, I think it was 2022, of the 59 or no, 57 nuclear reactors built up around the world, 49 of them were built up by companies that are Russian or Chinese. That's
Yeah, and a little
incredible.
Indian. Yeah.
And a little Indian too, right? I mean, but the BRICS nations, highly disproportionately, BRICS nations carrying the weight of the nuclear legacy. The West has been shutting it all down. The pro-NATO collective West has been shutting. Japan, you point out, lost. They shut down 38 of their reactors over the last. I think it was since Fukushima, since the tsunami. France shut down two, USA shut down 12. So we're going backwards. But as you pointed out, there's this interesting, by virtue of competency being demonstrated, in Eurasia, you actually are now creating a situation is being forced onto us, which is demanding that certain anti-nuclear narratives be erased in order to
Essentially.
unshackle. Yeah, it's fascinating what's going on, right? It, despite the interest or the paradigm of the oligarchy that would prefer it not happen, just by virtue of competency, it is happening. So very fascinating. We're gonna take a quick break, and then we're gonna come back, TNTRadio.live. All right, we're back for the second segment of the third hour on Connecting the Dots. I'm here with Alex Dimitrios, and we've been discussing the geopolitics of nuclear energy, the battles around the multipolar alliance, which has brought a standard of competency when it comes to energy policy and long-term thinking that is a breath of fresh air in my view and Alex's view, and has also forced the collective insane West, which has been committed to depopulation, degrowth, deconstruction of Western civilization for a long time, to begin to change a little bit. And you were bringing up, Alex, how even coming out of the last COP28 meeting, which these annual COP summits are typically weird imperial, like green imperial rituals that are trying to always corral and intimidate nations into giving up the sinful, according to the Gaia theory, the sinful carbon production systems that have allowed us to have industrial civilization to begin with, and also nuclear power has not been seen as friendly. This one has been different. Now, admittedly, hydrocarbon-based forms of energy were still not welcomed after the last COP summit, and I guess it was in Dubai. But you point out that there was a threefold increase in commitments in the collective Western nations to embark upon nuclear power.
That's right.
Can you say a little bit more about like what in your words resulted in this? Like, where is this coming from?
The West is seeing that the paradigm that we were trying to force on the third world is not going to work anymore. We've had about 25, what's it been now, 30 years since the fall of the USSR. And for a little while after the end of history, the West could get away with pushing a stagnation agenda on the rest of the world, or even a depopulation agenda. And what's broken through, multipolarity, contrary to some people's opinion, it is a pro-growth opinion because it causes this competition to start happening, where there's different games in town, and developing countries, some of them have to be cagier than others about playing both sides. Others can go fully one way or the other. But countries that want sovereignty are going with the BRICS nations, and the BRICS nations are providing nuclear energy technology. They're helping them build infrastructure, roads, bridges, airports, and they're bringing hydrocarbons, which means natural gas plants, coal, oil, you name it. So what's happening now is that there's a shift that's happening, and I don't think a lot of people are admitting it yet. But I think we're moving from a system of control to a system of at least controlled competition. And that's why, even though if you're a nuclear person, if you're into nuclear energy, if you're, nerd out on this stuff, the only game in town is Russia and China. That's where all the amazing advances are happening. China now has fourth generation nuclear reactors that they're actually building. In the United States, we're starting to have more advanced nuclear designs. But they're not actually getting produced. They're not market ready. They're still facing a lot of the old decades of nuclear propaganda that are still baked in. But these other, developing countries, they don't have that same propaganda. They're just seeing how they're looking. For example, just right now with the Houthis and the Suez Canal, if you rely on natural gas, which is still better than renewables, you still need a constant supply of natural gas reliably being shipped to you in these LNG terminals. And 10% of the natural gas in the world gets shipped through the Suez Canal. So if you're waiting for that shipment in Europe right now, they're going to be experiencing a ton of inflation this winter, simply because we blew up the Nord Stream pipeline. So then we're like, okay, well, we'll ship you guys LNG through the Suez Canal. And now that's getting blocked by the Houthis. So now they have to ship it an additional 7,000 miles around South Africa to just to get to Europe, just to power, their all-electric grid that they're trying to go to. So this is what the developing world is seeing. It's like, okay, well, which orientation can we go with? Is it the one that's built on chaos and intermittency that we can't build a civilization with? Or are we going to go with the one that's reliable, disciplined, logical, and wants to see us su succeed alongside them? And that's why they're picking Russia and China.
Yeah, that's really important. I think that transitions a little bit to people who have been watching this instead of simply listening on radio, have noticed that the subtitle of this show has been How the Club of Rome Shaped China's One China Policy. So I think that this is a good bridge because a lot of people would say, oh, but China is the role model for global population control and degrowth. Don't you know they're the obviously their one child policy is the model that will be used by the Davos crowd to control and regulate global populations according to social credit standards, all these things. You in your recent paper from well recent some months back, One Child Policy, Kissinger, Rockefeller Foundation, and the Club of Rome invaded China with Malthusian ideology. You did this in October. I loved it. I republished it on my website. You proved that there's more to this story. How do you respond to these people who are really of this anti-China perspective that China is the bearer of all Malthusian population control? And result, how does that resolve with the paradox of their enthusiasm for nuclear power, productivity, other things that you've outlined in your works?
Sure. Well, there's two kinds of people that are really into these narratives. Like you said, there's the anti-China people who say, "Oh, that's a Chinese one child policy, Malthusianism. That's Chinese. That's what they're doing." And also, there's either people that are really into multipolarity or really into communism, and they say, "Oh, well, China did it, so it must be good. They did it because they're a sovereign nation that's in 100% control of everything within their country, and they're doing it because it's Marxist and it's good." And both of these narratives are, at the end of the day, those are the real anti-China narratives. What really is happening is, for a long time, China is trying to develop their country. They need to be allowed to develop their country in order to get to where they want to go. So over the 1900s, the 20th century, Mao took control of the country in 1949. He had been, tutored under Sun Yat-sen, who him and he had a Confucian outlook, and also he was influenced by the American system. He was anti-Malthusian, and Mao kind of upheld those beliefs, and he was fervently anti-Malthusian. He believed in a big population for China, as a great asset for the nation. He wavered a little bit in the late 1950s, and there was a ferocious response in China, because that's just not how they're this that's just not how the civilization has developed. They have a very utilitarian outlook on nature, where they look at the tiger and they don't see it as a blessed, sacred being. They see it as, oh, there's 50 different kinds of medicine that we can get out of the tiger, and we can use the bones for this, this, and this. So they're very utilitarian about stuff like that. I don't claim to be a China whisperer, but that's what I've been told. And then in the 1960s, there's in the early 70s, as environmentalism developed in the West, there started to be this confluence of evil, shadowy, sinister groups that start to circle around China, and they see that China is looking to play ball. They're looking to develop. They want to overcome the failures of them attempting to develop their country. They hit some barriers due to a lack of investment and capital, fighting a war on many fronts. So the Rockefellers, the Club of Rome, and Henry Kissinger himself all had various entreaties and interactions with China. There are details to it. There's the NSSM report that Kissinger wrote. I don't know the exact number of it, where basically he warned about China's growing population. The Rockefellers invested a lot of money in family planning in Russia, which is code for let's prevent them from breeding too much. And then the Club of
In Russia
Rome.
and China, or just in
I'm
China?
sorry, in China. Did I say Russia? Yeah, I'm sorry, in China. And then the Club of Rome, they issued their limits to growth report, and it had a huge impact around the world. And what happened was that China, they were looking to not be a backwards country anymore. So they were looking around. Okay, well, what are Western countries doing and talking about? And what they did, Deng sent a missile scientist to population conferences around the world. And the scientist came back, and he was the architect of the one-child policy, eventually. And he said, "Oh, look, well, all these other countries—they're England's talking about cutting their population in half. Denmark's talking about cutting their population by 33%. This is what Western countries are doing. This is what we need to do." And it was with that kind of thinking they were very—they—they they bought the cybernetic psyop quite a bit from the Club of Rome crowd. And they crafted their own overpopulation policy, and they actually were able to pull it off. I think it was only strictly enforced in about 30% of the country. In the rural areas, which is most of the country, they were not able to literally enforce it. But the population of China did, the growth rate did level off significantly over several decades. And it wasn't because they came to it as a logical outcome that was best for the country. They came to it because it was what the West forced them to do. They were told in no uncertain terms on many fronts by the West, you're not going to get this outside funding. You're not going to get the capital flowing into your country. You're not going to be allowed to develop as much as you were unless you cut down the population growth rate. And there's a lot of
Yeah,
lessons in that.
I
Yeah.
it's
As
so
we look at the
important because I
country
mean
now. Yeah.
you absolutely, and you map it out so nicely. The knowing that at the same time as the Trilateral Commission funded by David Rockefeller was coming online in America and run by Kissinger's Zbigniew Brzezinski, at the same time as this deep state takeover of Malthusianism was being brought into the United States, the same agencies were at the same time focusing on infusing this poison into the governing strata and the population as a whole in China. And you bring up how it was David Rockefeller who went to China, and then 2 weeks later, you had the family planning leadership group set up in China with a whole program of facilitating Club of Rome thinking, including, as you pointed out, with this rocket scientist. I think you said his name was Ma Jian. He was bringing Club of Rome computer modeling into China, which was then part of the entire opening up program that really did so much damage in the long run.
Yeah.
Yeah, very, very important to get across that it's the same agency that hates China that also hates America at the same time, which is working both sides, that is latched on. And it's neither American nor Chinese per se. It's something else that people have to think about that's manipulating us.
Yeah, this didn't make it in the article, but in the 1980s, the one-child policy became a major source of a point of attack. By American Republicans against China, saying that, oh, look at this communist policy. This was part of the abortion battle in the United States, and the American Republicans were able to make abortion seem like it's a Chinese, communist plot for depopulation. When in fact, it was our very government, our very oligarchs were the ones that were pushing it on China, and then it got turned around. And you can see that again today. The Club of Rome is still in China, and just like Henry Kissinger is a respected figure in China, the Club of Rome is still an NGO operating in China, and now they're very influential with the Ecological Civilization Project in China, which is a softer form of I wouldn't say degrowth in China, but it's kind of putting the brakes on developing too fast. And it's a nod that China still has to make if they want all this ESG money flowing into their country through from the West, through Wall Street and the City of London. They do have to make some nods towards sustainability, And they're not, ecological civilization is not just something that they came up with in a vacuum. It's something that's being, through NGOs like the Club of Rome, which are still there, and the Population Council still funnel some money to China. They do have to make some nods to this stuff.
Yeah, and you pointed out the guy who runs it is not even Chinese. He's
Well, it's
Jörgen
what
Ronders, right? The former head
Jorgen
of the
Rand.
World Wildlife Fund International. That guy formerly ran the World Wildlife Fund International, and he's the one who's in charge of the Chinese Association for the Club of Rome. Like, what is this? And then also Maurice Strong lived out his last days also pushing this garbage inside of China. So there's this very, very influential thing. China's not, obviously hasn't fully liberated itself, would you say, from this operation?
No,
Yeah.
and a lot some of the pipeline between the United States and China, China loves to cross-pollinate and have build relationships and build kind of friendships in different vectors across China and America, but a lot of them are focused, laser focused on ecological civilization. And so that's why Jörgen Randers can go on CGTN. He's one of the original authors of the Limits to Growth Report, which, if read honestly, 50 years later, it's going to affect China more than anyone. That's the country that has the most potential for growth right now, with the biggest population and so many natural resources there that they can turn into technology. But he's welcome in China because they look at him and they say, okay, well, this is someone from the West that's very respected, and we should consider what he has to say. And maybe there are some aspects of what he has to say that they study, and they see what they can do to kind of address the concerns of Western environmentalists, because at the end of the day, environmentalism could be used as a vector to attack, to justify an invasion or a conflict with China. If taken very literally, they could, people could say, oh, well, they're exceeding the ecological limits, and they're doing more than any other country, and they're still not doing enough, and that's why we need to invade them or have some kind of conflict. So it's part of their security, I think.
The merger of the what was once the fringe left ecology movement with the right-wing neocon warmongering movement into some weird monstrous convergence is a strange thing. But yeah, you could see where this logic would necessarily flow to, with China having got pulled itself out of the Paris agreements from 2015 or the 2016 Paris Accords. China basically escaped earlier this year or last year. They're increasing the carbon footprint, so-called, by still utilizing coal, oil, natural gas in increasing rates and encouraging other nations, sin amongst sins, to do it themselves as well. So there's all, and also I think this is probably freaking out Randers and others. Is that they've also gotten rid of their one-child policy, their two-child policy, and they're actually now trying to recuperate from the self-damage inflicted upon themselves by going along with this thing back in the 70s, 80s, 90s. So with that, let's go for a quick commercial break, and we're going to pick that back up, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit about what China has done to heal itself or to try a healing process and extract this deep state entity from within itself over the past few decades. So we're going to come back in a couple of minutes with Connecting the Dots on TNT Radio Live.
All right. On today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, we're in for the third segment of the third hour with Alex Dimitrios of Space Commune. We were talking a lot about the Club of Rome, Rockefeller Foundation, Kissinger, infiltration of Malthusian ideology into China at the heart of the One China policy that did a lot of damage to China. And also created the basis, or at least increased what may have already been there in a limited degree, but really amplified this Chinese deep state structure of foreign entities that we could see, for those looking for it, we could see all sorts of evidence of battles to extract this thing. from within China. But at what point would you say that China really woke up to the fallacies and how much damage they were doing to themselves regarding this Rockefeller program, and changed their orientation to something that was more befitting a civilization with a future? Do you think that there was a moment, or was it a slower process of gradual sort of maybe we should stop doing this? It's not
I mean,
working. So.
it does seem like around 2010, around there. I mean, it was a process over time, and like I said, only 30% of the country really had the one-child policy enforced on them. It was more of a cultural shift that happened over many years. But I think around 2010, around the time the ascendancy of Xi Jinping, that you could see clear signs of them, I mean, officially condemning the program, or not making it the law of the land anymore, and then moving towards really bursting through the limits to growth with the massive expansion of their nuclear program, and building a nuclear program with Chinese characteristics, building what they call indigenous reactors. Where they absorb Western technology. Like you can see if you look at the design and the design histories of some of their current reactors, some of them are kind of descendants of French designs and United States designs, but then they really absorb them, make them their own, and make it work for their specific needs. So I would say around 2010, that's where they really officially made a break with that. And that's where ecological civilization has stepped into the void to be that olive branch to the West, where they say that we're actually doing the things that you guys want us to do, and please allow us to develop with minimal interference, and we'll make some of these nods to you, but without restricting our population.
Yeah. Well, it definitely took the wind out of the sails of a lot of people who would qualify themselves as Western, like greenies, I guess, who you could see would easily hate China because they're this giant industrial productive hub, which seems to run contrary to their ethos. But at the same time, they can't really say anything bad about it because China's actually got all of the solar panel and windmills, and they're doing green energy more efficiently than we are in many ways. But they're not putting their entire economy, they're not making their whole economy reliant on windmills and turbines. That's being used for its appropriate place in civilian centers, I suppose. But they have also hydrocarbon burning, a lot of nuclear power. On that note,
Well, that's an extremely good point, Matt. I'm glad you brought that up because if you look at the difference between how we use renewable energy in the West and how China does it, they own 95% of the supply chain for solar panels. So when they build solar panels and they deploy them in China, it means something completely different for them than it does if, for example, here, if we shut down a nuclear power plant and replace it with a whole, miles of solar panels. It's completely different for us. We're destroying our energy grid and we're going into debt to buy the solar panels. What they're doing, they're looking at their country and they're saying, okay, what do we have? We don't have a lot of oil. We don't have a lot of gas. They have to get their gas from Russia, but we have a lot of coal and we have a lot of lithium, and we have relationships with countries where we can get nuclear fuel. So when they're building solar panels, they're one of the few countries in the world where they can say they're increasing their energy security by building solar panels because they are actually willing to mine the lithium to do it, and they're actually willing to build the solar panels, and they don't go into debt to do it. The rest of the world, even though we can say, oh, we're pushing all the solar panels in the developing world, yeah, we're going into debt to buy them from China, and then we're forcing third world countries to do it in lieu of building reliable sources of energy. So it's completely different for us when they do it. And what's funny too is that the way they build solar panels and wind turbines, It's I know it must kill environmentalists inside a little bit. You know, there's famous videos of entire mountains that are just covered in solar panels, where you know they're clearly disrespecting the the ecological environment, and it's just completely they completely remade the landscape. It looks so bad. And environmentalists have to say, yeah, they're building more solar panels than anyone else. We should be like China. But you know, it's in a different, it's a completely different way for them.
In regards to nuclear power, a lot of people still are saying that China is only a copycat nation. You know, Peter Zeihan and others. You hear this repeated a lot. They don't do anything. They're not a creative people. They're just a mechanical Borg-like machine civilization that can't be creative or innovate, and they're just copying Western tech. In your analysis, looking at their And I know you've paid a lot of attention to their transportation technology, nuclear power technologies. Would you agree with that, or would you say that there's a flaw in that analysis?
No, I mean there. If you actually have to build something, so I mean, if you want to use Western, if you want to use Western propaganda, I mean, Steve Jobs had a famous quote where he says, "You know, real artists ship," and with China, they're actually building the nuclear power plants. So I think that's an amazing achievement on in and of itself. Sure, like in the United States, we have all these companies like Bill Gates's TerraPower. Where they have all these designs for small modular reactors that can power the, you know, data centers and Great Reset technologies of the future. But in China, they're actually building the small modular reactors. They're actually building highly advanced reactors that can even recycle nuclear waste and turn it into more energy. I just they have so much innovation happening, and from a legal perspective. They have iterated and creatively advanced the American Westinghouse designs and the French reactor designs to a point where, from a copyright perspective, they cannot even they're untouchable because they have advanced the technology so much where it's unrecognizable at this point. So I think it's bunk to say that they're you know a Borg-like entity that's just able to. Build, you know, they're just willing to build things through brute force and determination. There's a lot of craft and creativity there. Also with
But
coal,
those
I'll
who
say this
make
too, with coal, they've done amazing things to make coal cleaner. They actually are leading the world in clean coal technology because so much of their energy security is through coal. They know they're going to have to keep burning it for a long time, and it does create smoke. It does, you know, it does have negative effects for people that live nearby. And they've actually made amazing advances in squeezing out more productivity from burning less coal at their coal plants. So, I mean, they're doing things that other countries have never been able to do.
I was just reading as well on Life Science, how Chinese scientists have found a practical way of determining the electromagnetic spin of uranium molecules in ocean water, which are highly diffused, but there's still a lot of like diffused uranium molecules floating around. Each molecule on the periodic table has their own magnetic charge or magnetic signature. And you could calibrate devices that would just receive that particular magnetic signature and just compile. And in a sense, what they've done is they've been mining uranium now from ocean water, which is just mind-blowingly interesting, that there's these types of innovations happening. But you said something as well that I think I'd like to know a little bit more about, and I think a lot of people listening are probably of the view that nuclear waste is the worst thing in the world, and all we can do is bury it. You alluded to the fact that there is another approach that also we see China doing something about this other approach of reprocessing that doesn't involve just burying it for a million years. Can you say a little bit more about how that works at all,
Yeah.
or like?
It's a technology. I'm not, you know, this is an area that I'm not extremely well versed on, but the technology has existed for at least 40 years now, and we've actually attempted to build it in the West, where there are ways to reprocess spent nuclear fuel and byproducts from making nuclear energy. where you can make even more energy, and you can create this this loop where you just keep making more and more energy without even having to move Earth again to mine the uranium. In fact, there was a plant in the UK. It's called the Sellafield nuclear plant, and it was very controversial. It was most of the way built in the late 80s or early 90s. It was known as a first generation nuclear reprocessing plant, where they were taking uranium and nuclear products from the missile program in the UK and turning it into nuclear power, which is amazing, wonderful thing to do. I think that'd be a great benefit to humanity if we melted down some more nuclear weapons and turned it into fuel. And this was such a blow to the anti-nuclear propaganda of the time that Sellafield became, I wasn't around, I was a little, a little child at the time. I don't remember this, but apparently it was this huge thing. It was like a Live Aid style concert that U2 spearheaded, where it was the Stop Sellafield MTV concert, where they were just going all, going to the wall to stop this plant from being built that could turn nuclear weapons into nuclear fuel. Because basically that destroys the anti-nuclear argument that all nuclear is bad. Nuclear just means explosions and bombs and death and destruction. And, so they were trying to stop it. And one of our Substack articles you can find at spacecommie.substack.com is about how AOC, people like AOC and U2 suddenly flipped this year on nuclear, where AOC, U2, Greta Thunberg, they're all now saying that nuclear is okay or even critical, because they're looking at the reality of the multipolar world and they're seeing, oh geez, we can't even build weapons anymore. We can't even keep up with our supposed enemies in Russia and China without nuclear. We at least need nuclear to build weapons. And these people, we need to get them to say, oh, we need nuclear to raise the productive capacity of our nations, to give people a higher standard of living. That's really what we need. But they are suddenly just flipping on nuclear energy because they just see how the rest of the world is moving past us.
Yeah, no,
These
I
objectives
think it,
going
it,
away.
it's useful to sort of see this as a reflection of, because I mean, obviously these people you outlined are not decision makers unto themselves, but they're the expression of handlers who represent factions within the oligarchy, which has made certain decisions and recognized certain necessities that they have to bend to against their own will, because we know that the oligarchy's mandate is population reduction, keep people stupid, keep us as detached as possible from scientific and technological progress, which should be something reserved only for the inner elite, and otherwise, have a system of forever wars and keep the slaves fighting with themselves, keep them hungry in a land of scarcity. So the fact that we now have a shift away from that indicates that the oligarchy doesn't want to have nuclear, but they know that they have to. And you see the shadow of it in the form of a shift of narratives in the Wall Street Journal, as you eloquently pointed out. That's like a voice of the establishment, which is coming out with articles saying green investors are being crushed and the ESG craze is fading. And there's obviously a new messaging, kind of like we're seeing with Ukraine too, right? Where the obviously that didn't work out as planned, and so there's a new messaging being put out as they're trying to change course for this giant ship. With its trajectory, that's really hard to change it, because that's decades of propaganda of mechanism under it, pushing it in a certain direction. And they're like, no, we have to change course because we can't compete. We can't do battle with this thing we despise that's pro-population growth in the multipolar alliance. So it's interesting to see this thing pan out the way it is, eh?
Yeah, they're relying on us to be like goldfish, and they want us to have the memory of goldfish swimming in the wake of the giant ship that you're talking about. And we're like, oh, well, a nuclear, U2 says that nuclear is good now. I have no memory of what happened 30 years ago, how they stopped an amazing program from happening in the UK. Just nuclear is good
Yeah.
now.
It's a sad irony, eh? Like a big chunk of the anti-nuclear movement was originally recruited based on the idea of stopping nuclear war, which is a legitimate thing to want to stop nuclear bombs. That's fine. But despite the fact that that's what won the hearts of a lot of young people in the 60s and the 70s to the anti-nuclear movement, nuclear war only increased in danger over the course of the next 40 years. And it's only been the civilian peaceful use of nuclear power that has suffered and has been shut down. But the actual danger of a geopolitical conflagration of thermonuclear war has only increased despite all of that. So it is a sad irony.
And you can see that with Ed Markey, who's the U.S. senator, who's the main architect of the Green New Deal. In the 80s, he blocked uranium shipments from going to India. India is a place where they burn dung to create electricity. He blocked them from getting nuclear fuel because of this fake program of stopping nuclear war, but he just stopped them from developing a good electrical infrastructure for their people, and it still hurts them today.
Ay, it's painful, eh?
It
So look,
does.
I thank you so much for this briefing. Where do people reach you? How do they follow your work? How do they follow Space Commune? What do they do?
So follow Space Commune on X, Space Commune on X, spacecommune.com, and then we have our Substack, spacecommune.substack.com. Those are the places to see the articles. We have a lot of good stuff coming out this year.
Wonderful. And your documentaries are fantastic as well. So keep an eye out for that. Thank you so much, Alex. And till next time, till next week, this is Matt Arrett on Connecting the Dots. Take care.